Good afternoon. It's Thursday, March 13th. Starting the meeting at 1:34. Present Senator Ellis, Senator Stedman, Senator Olson, myself, Senator Dunleavy. We expect Senator Machicki here any second. We do have a full agenda today. We have several bills that we're going to be hearing. We have SB 166, Board of Nursing, Nurses, SB 167, Multiple Vehicle Insurance Policies, SB 156, Direct Entry Midwives, SB 190, Delegation of Guide Outfitter Duties, SB 140, ADA, Arctic Development Authority, SB 99, ADA Development Loans, SB 193, Contractors Bonds Licensing. So, we are going to start off with SB 166. It's a bill sponsored by Senator Giesel. We heard this at the last meeting. So if Senator Giesel and Jane Conway can come up, introduce themselves for the record. It's going to be the second hearing on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Senator Kathy Giesel, District N. I'm going to have my aide, in the interest of time, present the bill.
Chairman Dunleavy and members of the committee, Jane Conway, staff to Senator Giesel. As you said, this is our second hearing. We had a robust conversation last time. You adopted version Y, which had just a couple of very small changes from the version O. This bill incorporates changes that have come before the Board of Nursing for the past 10 years. So we are updating the statute to keep up with modern technology and medical practices. We are available for questions. We have Pat Center from Alaska Nurses Association online for questions. We also have Beth Farnstrom and Nancy Sanders from the Board of Nursing available for questions as well. And with that.
Thank you. So this is our second hearing on the bill. Do we have questions from members of the committee on SB 166?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
So through the chair, Jane, who was online? Excuse me.
Pat Center from Alaska Nurses Association, Beth Farnstrom, the executive administrator for the Board of Nursing, Beth Farnstrom is the chair, and Nancy Sanders is the executive administrator for the Board of Nursing, who are all online.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, if we could have Ms. Center address the committee, and this may have happened at a previous hearing that I wasn't available for, but I'd be interested in Ms. Center's representation of the profession or members of her group and their feeling about the bill one way or another.
Sure. And how does Ms. Center, are you online?
Yes, this is Pat Center, and I'm Professional Practice Director with the Alaska Nurses Association. And the Alaska Nurses Association is in support of this bill. We saw commented on an early draft at a Board of Nursing meeting, and we are in support of the version that is before you.
Questions for members of the committee for Ms. Center? So we also have, as was mentioned, we have Beth Farnstrom online. Janice Shockman online, all related to SB 166, I believe. Ms. Shockman, are you online? Ms. Shockman?
Yes, I am.
Could you please identify yourself for the record, and if you have testimony, please please proceed. If not, we may ask you some questions.
My name is Jana Shockman. I am president of the Alaska Nurses Association. And as Pat Center just mentioned, the Alaska Nurses Association is in support of the bill as written, and I am available for questions.
Questions for Ms. Shockman? Seeing none at this time. Ms. Farnstrom, are you online?
Yes. Hi, this is Beth Farnstrom, and I'm the chair of the Alaska State Board of Nursing.
Any questions for Ms. Farnstrom, related to the bill? Seeing no questions, we do have folks from the department here, I believe. Folks from the department, are you here? That would be Gray Mitchell,
yes.
Sarah Chambers, and Don Haberger. Are there members of the committee that would like to have these folks come up to ask them any questions? Sure, Senator. So if we could have Gray Mitchell, and would it be Sarah Chambers? Or
actually, it would be Don Haberger.
Okay, Don Haberger.
Mm-hmm.
Please come up. Yes. State your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Don Haberger, Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Haberger, last time we had a discussion as to the level of education that somebody needs to be in management, essentially, of what's gone on there. I was wondering if you'd reconsider your position, as you appeared to be somewhat pessimistic about our ability to go and fill some of the positions. I was wondering if you'd reconsider your, or was that still a concern that you have with your standpoint in the Division of Occupational Licensing?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it's still my position. I still think that flexibility for the division to recruit and hire is better than narrowing that down. If I may, an example might be a master's in nursing home administration as opposed to just a degree in nursing. Could that person administrate a nursing program? I would conclude yes, and I stand on that position.
Mm-hmm. One other question, Mr. Chairman, and this may be a question for Beth Farnstrom, has to do with, in licensing, obviously a person's most valuable essentially piece of paper out there is their license. How many actions have you taken against somebody's license in the last, let's say, 2 years, 5 years, or whatever?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't have
either a suspension or
I don't have that information in front of me. If I recall, for 1 year, we were about 250 actions for FY13 on licenses, our entire breadth of the program.
But an action, that's more of an investigation as opposed to an actual dealing with somebody's license where you actually suspend it and revoke it, isn't it?
No. These were actions, either a consent agreement or it could have been a board revoking or suspending a license.
Whatever the spirit. I guess, Mr. Chairman, if I can continue, where I'm going with this, I'm wondering is the level of education that's there in the regulatory arm of the Board of Nursing or what's dealing with the licensure, is that even an issue?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I understand your line of questioning, but I would argue that our board members are vested with that authority and that experience, mm-hmm. and they're placed on the board because they have those license credentials and are best able to determine that. I do recognize that there is a level of review that the executive administrator does, and that review does take some expertise. And I think current statute, which recognizes a registered nurse license, is sufficient.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Additional questions for Mr. Haberger from members of the committee? Seeing none, we're going to open this for public testimony. Is there anyone online that wishes to testify on this? Bill 166? Anyone in the audience that would like to testify on 166? Seeing none, we're going to close public testimony. Any last comments or questions from members of the committee? Seeing no further discussion, what is the will of the committee?
I have a motion, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Machicki.
I move Senate Bill 166-28-LS-1010-O with the attached fiscal note and individual recommendations to the next committee of referral.
So any objection to the motion?
Version 1.
Okay. I stand corrected. I move Senate Bill 166-28-LS-1010, version Y.
So any objections to the motion? Seeing none, the bill moves from committee, and we're going to take a brief of these. We're back in session. We now turn to SB 167. It's a bill sponsored by Senator Huggins. Presenting the bill would be Ashley Compton, staff to Senator Huggins. Please come forward. State your name for the record. Begin your testimony. This is going to be the second hearing on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ashton Compton, and I'm staff to Senator Charlie Huggins. SB 167 is a bill aimed at addressing an unintended loophole in Alaska statute that is harmful to consumers of uninsured, underinsured motorist insurance, also known as UUIM. With a couple simple changes to the language, the statute will be made consistent with its intent, which was to limit UUIM stacking. It will resolve an inconsistency that unfairly and unnecessarily forces consumers to purchase insurance they don't desire or need. And with that, if you guys have any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Compton on SB 167 from members of the committee? Okay. Seeing none, we do have Mr. Hester from the administration. Mr. Hester, would you like to come forward too and be prepared to answer any questions from the committee? Please state your name for the record.
For the record, Martin Hester, Deputy Director, Division of Insurance.
Any questions for Mr. Hester or members of the committee? Okay, seeing none, we're going to open this up for public testimony. Is there anyone online? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience that would like to speak upon this bill? Seeing none, we're going to close public testimony. Any last comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, is there a motion to move this bill?
There is, Mr. Chairman. I move SB 167-28-LS-1314 version A with the attached fiscal note and individual recommendations to the next committee of referral.
Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, the bill moves from committee. We'll take a very brief at ease. Back online. We're now turning to SB 156. This is a bill from Senator Kelly. This is the first hearing on the bill. Presenting the bill is Heather Shattuck, staff to Senator Kelly. Ms. Shattuck, would you come forward? Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Heather Shattuck, staff to Senator Pete Kelly. And on behalf of Senator Kelly, I'd like to thank you for hearing this bill, SB 156, an act related to direct entry midwives. The concept for this bill was brought to Senator Kelly this fall by representatives of the Midwives Association of Alaska. The statutes pertaining to the practice of midwifery were put into statute in 1992 and have not been updated since then. As many of you are aware, placing specific practices of a profession in statute stymies the growth and management of the profession by their board. These initial required practices were placed into statute before a functioning board of certified direct entry midwives even existed. So the board has tried to establish and develop a comprehensive regulatory framework through practice, regulations, and guidelines crafted to ensure public safety and professional discipline. However, these outdated statutes cement certain obsolete practice requirements in place and can only be updated by an act of the legislature. So SB 156 will update the statutes. It'll place the certified direct entry midwives required practices into regulation and add to the public safety around the profession. This enables the board to oversee the profession more effectively and incorporate currently national best practice. nationally recognized best practices. And this type of authority is granted to many professional boards in the state in order to develop and maintain professional practice standards. So we address the public safety piece in a couple of ways. The Midwives Association requested that a higher threshold of training be in place in order for a licensed certified direct entry midwife to act as a supervisor to an apprentice midwife. And their profession uses apprentices, so the licensed midwives are teaching the new upcoming apprentices. In addition to the requirement of being licensed for 2 years, SB 156 further requires a licensed CDM to attend 50 or more births in order to supervise an apprentice. Putting in such a threshold will enable a greater level of expertise on a midwife before they take on that extra responsibility. We also address well baby care by covering the scope of CDM practice for up to 4 weeks after birth. And that's just ensuring that the delivering midwife who's following with the mom all through the pregnancy can follow up with the baby. And already in statute, we have certain required tests that occur after 7 days. And currently, a midwife can only cover a baby up to 7 days. And right now, we have a lot of midwives that are covered, or the moms that are covered by Denali Kid Care. Well, that care for the baby ends after 7 days. And even though we have tests that are required by law, so if the midwives have to perform the tests on the newborn, they're not getting those paid for by Denali Kid Care if it's after 7 days. So it's our belief allowing the midwife to properly follow up with the newborn will improve their care and make sure they're thriving. So SB 156 also repeals the cultural midwives exemption, which will require all CDMs in the state to be licensed and under the disciplinary regulation of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives. Currently, an individual whose cultural traditions have included for at least 2 generations the attendance of midwives at birth and has assisted at least 10 births does not fall under the regulation of the board. So the Midwives Association just asks that we bring everybody under the same scope of practice and regulation and the same level of education required. So midwives are a good option that women with low-risk pregnancies have in Alaska. And I'll also point out that these services are reimbursed at a much lower cost than other options under Medicaid. So it's certainly a savings to the Medicaid budget. It is Senator Kelly's goal to allow the Board of Direct Entry Midwives to be as effective and efficient as possible in their oversight in the field. And I have some phone-a-friends here with, I should have Cheryl Korick, who is the chair of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives on the phone, as well as Susan Terwilliger, who is the president of the Midwives Association. And there is another individual in the audience who was actually around when these regulations were put into statute.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Shattuck? There are a number of folks online and in the audience that are wanting to testify on this issue. But since we have Ms. Shattuck in front of us, do we have questions for members of the committee?
I can wait till afterwards, but if we're short on testimony, I'm trying to get the testimony out of the way.
It's if you have a question, Senator, we can do it now.
And it may be somebody else that can answer the question better than I. Not that she's not knowledgeable, but what's the requirement now if you're trying to go and increase the number to 50? What's the requirement now to become certified?
So that piece that we're changing is just to oversee an apprentice. And currently, a certified direct entry midwife has to be licensed in the state for 2 years, and then they can oversee an apprentice.
So if I understand what you're saying, the answer to the question is there is no number that a person has to be before they become a CDM, a certified direct midwife. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I believe it's just to oversee an apprentice. So they do have licensing requirements, but I think I will let the chair of the board answer that.
Is that Ms. Twilliger?
No, that would be Cheryl Cork.
There'll be other questions along that line, but one of the questions I do have, how many rural midwives are there out there that would be affected by this? Do you have any idea?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I do not have a hard and fast number. Mm-hmm. The reason they brought that provision to us was it has been their understanding that has not been used as intended. Mm-hmm. So I think the number is very little that it may actually affect, and I think it's more that folks who are using that provision incorrectly are going to be affected.
And my last question, Mr. Chairman, has to do with complaints. Obviously, complaints against somebody's license is something that's near and dear to a person's heart because that's part of their identity as well as making a living. Are there complaints that prompted this legislation?
I'm sorry, can you?
Are there complaints that prompted this legislation? Was there a bad outcome to a birth that said, you know, if I had had 49 more births, I would have probably been a little more up to speed on seeing things that are going haywire, because let's face it, things can go bad very quickly when you're in between halfway in and halfway out type of thing. And things don't go well, come down the birth canal, coming down the birth canal.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, and I will again let the boards clarify. I know there were problems, and they wanted to make sure everybody was properly certified, which is why they brought this legislation to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Shattuck at this time? Thank you. Seeing none, Susan Terwilliger, are you on the phone or online?
Yes, I am.
Would you like to state your name for the record, who you're associated with, and begin your testimony?
Yes, my name is Susan Terwilliger. I'm the president of the Midwives Association of Alaska. I am a certified direct entry midwife and a preceptor with a home birth practice in Eagle River. And I speak for both myself and the MAW members who have supported the presentation of this bill. I do want to address the senator's question about the numbers. I want to clarify that the 50 births, this applies only to the midwife who's going to be a preceptor. There's a lot more births the numbers are clearly regulated as to getting one's license in the first place. So that particular issue is about who's qualified to be a teacher, not the certification. So I hope that clarifies what the senator was talking about. Alaska has a pretty good midwifery law that was created decades ago, but it needs updating for both public safety, as in expanding the requirements to become a preceptor, and for keeping current with the latest childbirth information and studies. Midwifery care is a service many women in Alaska seek as an option for their pregnancy care and birth, and they expect our licensing laws to reflect best practices. Moving the practice requirements that are currently in statute into regulations will make it so that issues can be added to or updated by the board. We also want to add into that statute definition of midwifery that we give the well baby care up to 4 weeks and that we supervise apprentices. Midwives are already doing this and have been doing this across the United States since the advent of modern midwifery 50 years ago, but it needs to be in our statute. I think Alaska has a wonderful opportunity to be the model for direct entry midwifery in the country, and I think passing this bill would promote public safety and the best practice of midwifery. So thank you for your consideration of this bill.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Twilliger from members of the committee?
Actually, I do, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson?
Mr. Willinger, thanks for coming out and spending time and your serving as the president of the Midwifery Association. One of the first questions I had is, how many births does a CDM have to have before they're eligible for a license?
I don't know that. You'd need to ask one of the other midwives. I came in through reciprocity because I had a midwifery license in Texas, and I got my Alaska license 9 years ago by examination and similar licensing.
I
don't know exactly what the CDM, and I'm sure some of the other women online can answer that.
Can I ask you how many births you've attended?
I've attended about 750 births.
Okay. And one of the other questions, since you're a president of the association, are there complaints out there that prompted this legislation?
No complaints. What prompted this legislation was just years of frustration and not being able to update for best practice. Because, as the aide said, the original law was written in 1992 and hasn't been able to been updated. So that was the only prompting of this bill.
Mr. Chairman, if I could continue, and that's I guess that's my point, is that as a public policy maker, we're looking at a process that happens, in, which is specifically childbirth, that's happened since the beginning of time with Cain and Abel, that and throughout that period of time, why is it that now all of a sudden we've got to have at least 50 births before somebody can be a preceptor when there's been no complaints?
Both the board and the membership, the Midwives Association membership, agreed that what was written before was that you had your license for 2 years, and that we felt it was in the profession's best interest to add to that, just for professionalism.
So just, Mr. Chairman, if I could, just for professionalism, I see this putting the rural midwives at a disadvantage out there where they're trying to go ahead and provide a service where doctors are few and far between, especially with OB experience, but you seem to be restricting them, which may work out for a midwife that's in downtown Anchorage or Fairbanks for that matter, but when you start talking about someplace like Dutch Harbor or out in Savunga or someplace like that, they seem to be at a disadvantage. Is that not true?
Well, we're talking about the ability to teach other midwives. So we didn't feel like, we're not saying that they can't practice. We're talking about them teaching other midwives.
Mr. Chairman, it's been my experience as a former health aide before I went to medical school, that the health aide population is getting older. They need to be taught, and that they need the ability to be taught out there, because that's where you're going to need the help, and that's where you're going to have the most catastrophic results, is out in some rural area where they're all by themselves. And if there's a restriction or if there's a hesitancy on the side of somebody that's out there hired either to be a preceptor, that all of a sudden they're scared or they're not able to do it because they haven't had 50 births. I guess I'm calling that in question in light of the fact that, one, there's been no complaints. Number two, it's just for professionalism. I guess I seriously question that this bill should be going through, because it puts rural midwives and rural sites at a disadvantage with the clinics in particular. Tell me where I'm wrong in my thinking.
Well, I would like to bring in Cheryl Corrick, who is the chair of the board, into this conversation and have her give her opinion about that, because I just think that I'd like for her to also be able to address this issue, if that's all right.
Mr. Chairman, that's your call.
Ms. Clark, are you online?
Yes, this is Cheryl Clark.
Okay, could you please state your name for the record and who you're associated with, and we'll be asking you some questions.
Yes, my name is Cheryl Clark. I'm a certified direct entry midwife in Fairbanks and a certified professional midwife with the National Association of Registered Midwives. I have 20 years of experience in the field of midwifery, and I'm currently serving as the chair of the board of certified direct entry midwives.
Senator Olson, do you have questions for Ms. Cork?
Ms. Cork, did you hear the questions I had before?
I did, and I don't think there's any error in your thinking, Senator. This is something the board has considered for a number of sessions, at least. There was some concern that was brought up at one point by some rural midwives, exactly the concern you had, that it would be harder for them to get these 50 births before they could become preceptors for other midwives. Again, we've considered that. We're looking at the professional aspect of it. We're not really considering health aides here because they're already exempted from this midwifery regulation. But as far as midwives go, we had noticed a trend that a lot of the complaints that were coming in that were going to investigations, sometimes those midwives were coming from preceptors that didn't have much experience. Honestly, that was talked about in board meetings, and it was decided to, when the Midwives Association did this bill, to go ahead and include this part of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, as you said, that the preceptors, was it because the preceptors that didn't quite meet the qualifications were not available with those that had over 50, or why were they being overseen by, why was the concern there, I guess?
Well, the trend that we noticed was that the preceptors that had less experience, they were precepting these midwife apprentices who would get licenses, and more of those licensed midwives were having complaints and going to investigations than the ones that had very qualified preceptors.
So if I understand you right, Ms. Corrick, there have been complaints out there with the possibility of licensure action that prompted this legislation.
In my 6 years on the board, I've noticed that trend, yes, and it has been discussed as a trend.
And so who do I ask how many licenses have actually been suspended or revoked because of complaints?
To my knowledge, very few, and not during the time I've been on the board has there actually been suspension or revocation. There has been some memorandums of agreements and some other disciplinary measures.
And the last question I have, Ms. Corrick, is that, you know, the issues that I'm bringing up may not even be an issue because how many rural midwives are out there in total and how many would be affected by this legislation?
That probably would be a question for Connie Petz, but I can just say, as far as I know, very few midwives are rural at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. thank you, Ms. Cork. Is Dana Brown online?
Yes.
Dana Brown, please state your name for the record and who you're associated with, and we may have some questions for you.
Okay. Yes, this is Dana Brown from Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm the director of Alaska Family Health and Birth Center. I have been licensed since 1993 when the first licenses were issued. I have served on the Direct Entry Midwife Board in the past, and I am in support of Senate Bill 156, and I thank you all for hearing it.
Any questions?
While I was on the board, we did have times when we would try to pass regulation that would bring practice up to date and then would end up having what was in statute prevent that from happening. And because it was all put together so many years ago, it really does need to be brought up to current standards. So I am in support, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Brown? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Brown, you seem to be one of the few the clinician of the hour since you're the director there and have been licensed for such a long period of time. Have you ever practiced out in rural Alaska?
No, we have rural areas that we serve here in Fairbanks. Most people that live out in villages come in for their birth because it's much safer to be closer to a hospital. And so the direct entry midwives in the state, for the most part, practice near cities and towns. And they do serve rural areas, like I said. But the standard of care in Alaska is for people to have access to higher levels of care as well and be closer to a hospital. So people from, like I said, people from villages, they come in to be closer to a hospital.
Senator Olson?
Ms. Brown, I understand where you're coming from. Where I'm coming from, though, is for some reason you have a precipitous birth out in a rural station that people that have, we all are much more comfortable with childbirth happening in the hospital where you have C-section capabilities as well as medications that are available. But when you have a precipitous birth out in a rural site, that's where I see that those people out there that I represent are at a disadvantage.
Yes, but there are no licensed midwives out in those areas. And this bill doesn't affect people that would be like a health aide or someone that's out in a village, this bill does not affect them in any way because they're not under the jurisdiction of this license of the direct entry midwife.
So, Ms. Brown, if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying there are no certified direct midwives out in rural Alaska.
Well, I guess I'd like you to define rural.
Well, let's put it this way. Fairbanks is not rural.
Right. So are you talking like Kuskokwim or a village?
That's actually the bush. I'm talking about rural like Bethel or Barrow,
yes,
or Coxsabie or Nome or Killian.
Yeah, well, Bethel does have a hospital. But there are no direct entry midwives that I know of practicing in villages that don't have road systems or, you know.
But you don't know for sure.
I'm 99% positive.
Thank you, Ms. Brown.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Next, we have Judy Davidson up in Wasilla. Are you online, Judy? Judy Davidson, are you online? Okay. Let's go next to Jenneth Lucas. Are you online, Ms. Lucas?
Yes, I'm here.
Jenneth Lucas, can you please state your name for the record, who you're associated with, and if you have testimony?
Yes. My name is Jenneth Lucas. I am a consumer. And I chose midwifery care for my birth because it is flexible both to my needs as a consumer and to current best practices. I know that my midwives are aware of the most recent studies and best practices regarding safe childbirth, and the regulations that govern them should be adaptable to those standards. With my first child, I moved very shortly after his birth, and I did not receive any newborn care from my midwife. But here in Alaska with my second, very recent birth, I did receive newborn care despite the fact that my midwife was not reimbursed. I felt it was important to receive this continued care for myself and for my newborn from the midwife who was most familiar with my pregnancy and birth. I think this bill is really important to continue and to improve the midwifery care provided to Alaskan consumers.
Thank you. Next, we're moving on to, I hope I pronounce your name correctly, Saskia Esslinger in Anchorage?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, could you please state your name for the record and who you're associated with, if any, organization, and then begin your testimony?
Yes. My name is Saskia Esslinger, and I am also a consumer, so I'm just representing myself. I've given birth to two beautiful, healthy boys at my home in Anchorage with the help of a midwife. Home birth was the healthiest, safest, and most comfortable option for me. While I was pregnant, I noticed that the regulations did not always allow for the most current standards of practice. I support SB 156 because it would allow the board to update and revise the practice guidelines to keep up with the current standards. SB 156 would also enhance public safety by requiring more experience for preceptors and eliminating a cultural exemption to the training and education required for licensed midwives. Please vote for SB 156.
Thank you. Next, do we have Stevie K. McNeil? Did you know? No? We also have Sarah Chambers here that can answer questions. Sarah is with the Department of Commerce. Sarah? Please come forward. Hi.
Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Administrative Operations Manager for the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for Ms. Chambers? Senator?
Thank you, Ms. Chambers. There's been a discussion by Ms. Brown at Fairbanks that there were no licensed midwives out in rural Alaska. Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, we don't track easily whether someone is in rural Alaska or in a more populated area of the state, but we could certainly look into where our licensees are located according to addresses and get back to you with that.
Okay. And do you have any idea how many midwives are going to be affected by this that don't have, for example, 50 births documented to allow them to be preceptors? So, I mean, obviously one lady that spoke said she had 750, but she'd come here under reciprocity, so I'm assuming that she had a fair number before she even got here.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it's my expectation from an administrative standpoint that the board would need to look into how to implement this statute and that they would need to adopt regulations to implement it, and through that process would be able to determine how many midwives currently would not have 50 births. Midwives are, through their renewal process, requested to submit information about their practice, and it's certainly possible that midwives would hold a license but not be actively practicing with that license. So it's very possible that there's a section of the licensed midwife population that would affect, but we wouldn't know that information without additional research.
If we could continue, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator.
How many births are now required before somebody gets a license? Do you have any idea?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I'm not certain of that number. There are additional requirements such as examination and coursework that midwives need to present. I would defer those specific questions to the chair if she's still online.
Sure. My last question has to do with the department. Is the department in favor of this legislation?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, this is primarily under the purview of the board. There are very few administrative, if any, real administrative outcomes from the bill other than assisting the board with passage of regulations. So we would defer to the board in their judgment of making those decisions as proposed in statute.
So the department doesn't have a position on it?
I would agree with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Machicki.
Ms. Chambers, and I have ultimate respect to the senator next to me who's a physician. I just happen to be a dad. And the value in, again, we're talking about the person who can be essentially the proctor, right, in training a new direct entry midwife. It used to be on a time basis, and I just have to say that I don't, in the case of a birth, I don't care if it's 20 years, if you hadn't had enough experience, in my view of delivering, the time doesn't seem to have any value. I think it being on a number of births seems to have more value, which is, I guess I can understand the change, and I don't, the senator next to me can let me know about this, but it seems to me like anyone can deliver a baby. The value is in understanding when something's going wrong, and I think that takes delivery experience in order for that to have the most value. So I guess in my view, and I've had almost, 10% of the required births of the midwife that would have to train this of my own children. I can see the value in a birth number. Maybe 50 is not the right number, but it seems to me like the time had no value. Time and grade had no value. Number of births seems to be the sort of right indicator of experience.
Question? Statement? Statement. Questions? Statement. I have a question. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is the term placenta in Creta? Does that sound familiar?
Mr. Chairman, as a member of the administration and a mom, I'm not familiar with that term.
Actually, there's a couple of there's an accreta, there's stages of accreta, and then you have in Creta as well. So it's it's one that catches your attention, let's put it that way. And I'm not talking about you in particular, you and your lawyer, if you're involved.
Well, I will thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I was looking up some information about a number of investigations, mm-hmm. listening to prior testimony. The midwives had 62 licensees in fiscal year 13 and 8 investigations, just to follow up on that piece of information.
Okay. Thank you. Any additional questions for Ms. Chambers? Senator Chickie.
No, actually, I have one for the president of the board. when we get to that, we get back to that point, sir.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Wheeler, are you still online?
Yes.
We have a question from Senator Machicki.
Yes, I'm president of the Midwives Association, not chair of the board.
Okay,
I'm not sure where you wanted to direct
you
your question.
Ms. Corrick.
Ms. Corrick, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Senator Machicki has a question for you.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
Ms. Corrick, if you can, you heard my logic earlier. I mean, would you agree with that? That just as the person essentially delivering the training of new direct entry midwives, that the number of births probably has more value than the length of time and service? Is that the reason for the change? I'm just trying to understand that.
Yes, well, that's my thinking anyway, Senator. And to answer your other question, in order to get licensed as a certified direct entry midwife, the apprentice has to attend 60 births. 10 of those are observations, 20 are assisting at the birth, and 30 are being the primary provider under the supervision of the preceptor. So if you're asking or adding another 50 births to that, the licensing process takes approximately 2 years. So within 2 years, that midwife should be able to get about 50 births unless they go from the setting they were in as an apprentice and move to a more rural area, then it might be more difficult. But it does tell the board that that midwife has more experience when they have 50 births.
Thank you.
Questions? Members of the board or members of the committee? Thank you very much. I need to officially open public testimony at this time. Public testimony is open. I neglected to do that. Apologize. Is there anyone else that would like to testify online to this bill, 156? Is there anyone here present that would like to testify on 156?
Yes, this is Judy Davidson.
Okay, Ms. Davidson. Okay.
I'm from Madison Midwifery and Family Health in Wasilla, Alaska, and I also have been licensed since 1993 when the state first provided licensure for direct entry midwives. And I one thing that I would like to say is I think it's very important for the committee to understand that direct entry midwives are licensed to provide care to low-risk women. From previous discussion about rural precipitous births, this is something that can be very high risk, and direct entry midwives are trained in precipitous birth, and I think it is a vision that many of us have that there would be more midwives for women in areas like that. I know that many of the birth centers and many of the directors that Cheryl and Dana and even Susie that have been talking today also provide training. We're all preceptors. We provide training. I myself have provided training to people wanting to train from Kodiak and other areas of our state, and that is something that we would like to be able to do in our apprenticeship programs, but we are trained to provide low-risk, to provide care to women. And part of the reason we wanted to update our statute is to show that we are qualified to do that. We are qualified as preceptors to train midwives in what could end up being a high-risk case. As you know, anything can happen at the very end at birth. And we also want to show good collaboration of care with nurse midwives and in the hospital setting and physicians, that we have a level of care to at least acknowledge when we are practicing, when it's getting outside of our scope and we know when to refer so that we have good outcomes for our moms and babies. I wanted to say that Alaska is on the cutting edge of the way that it provides midwifery care to the public. We have the highest rate of out-of-hospital births in the United States, and our little state is looked to as an example. Most other states in our nation have about a 1% out-of-hospital rate of birth. We have a 6%. So I, for one, am very proud of what midwives have done in the state, and I'm very proud that we are updating our standards, I hope, to show, an excellent quality of care and continued progress to reflect the standard of maternity care that we have now. It's much different than it was 22 years ago when we first passed our original law. A lot of people didn't even know what midwives were. I often had to explain that as a young midwife.
Questions? Thank you very much. We have another individual here present in person. Please come forward. State your name for the record. Tell us who you're with and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Kay Connie. I'm a certified direct entry midwife here in Juneau, and I've been practicing as a midwife in Juneau for 30 years. I was involved in the first piece of legislation that was passed in 1985 to keep midwifery legal. We tried to create a board then and were not able to. In 1992, we did pass legislation to create a board for certified direct entry midwives, and I served on the licensing board for the first 8 years and helped craft these regulations. I just want to address, first of all, the preceptor issue. I do think that the number of births that a midwife has attended since she's been licensed is really important as far as having the knowledge to be a preceptor. I don't think that the number of years is important. For instance, I have a student sitting with me here. She was a student. She's now been licensed for 8 months, but she's attended 180 births. You know, so she's very qualified to be a preceptor, and yet she cannot be a preceptor until she's been licensed for 2 years. So, you know, it's definitely the numbers of births that's more important than the numbers of years. I also just want to say, as far as the list of required practices that we're trying to move into regulation, that list was put into statute in the beginning because we did not have a board. We did not have regulations in place. And so it's really important that we had, you know, some stipulation in statute. Since we have a very well-functioning board now that's no longer required to be in statute, it should be in regulation where the board could keep it up to date. So I'm here to answer any questions. Thank you for letting me change my mind and testify.
Question, Senator Michicki.
I just wanted to clarify. I made the statement anyone can help deliver a baby, and that's not one of those Republican guy things. It's just a baby's coming whether you like it or not. I think everyone knew what I meant, I hope. But, yeah, I think the experience is key on identifying when something's going wrong, and that's where the mystery lies for the untrained. So just wanted to make sure my comments weren't misunderstood.
Thank you. Any questions?
Sure.
Senator?
Are you in favor of the legislation?
Oh, yes, I'm definitely in favor of this legislation. And
what?
Because I think it will make our law stronger and better, and it will give the board more authority and be more able to regulate midwives in the state of Alaska.
Well, you just stated that you didn't like the 2 years.
Oh, you know, I'm just saying that the numbers of births is more important than the time. The 2 years is okay. I'm just, you know, it's the numbers that are more important.
Sure.
We already have the 2 years in place. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think we need to change that. I think the number of births. Somebody could get licensed, and you only have to do 5 births a year to keep your license. So somebody could be licensed and only have done 10 births in that two years. So that doesn't necessarily qualify them to teach than other midwives.
Chairman, okay. Continue.
Yes, Senator.
As far as that's the number of births, what about continuing education? We take CMEs and nurses take something or else, and the lawyers take CLEs. Is there a requirement for continuing education?
There is. The law requires 20 hours of continuing education per licensing period. So 10 hours of continuing education units or contact hours per year.
Where do you have to go to get that?
We do have a conference here, an annual conference. There's a lot of in-services or trainings offered in the state. A lot of us go out of state to different midwifery conferences to get that training.
My real question has to do, can you get it online so that somebody out in as long as they have internet connection, can go ahead and get their license renewed?
You can. You can get a lot of that education online.
And that's a biannual license?
It's a biannual license.
Okay.
And I might add a very expensive one.
The last question I have, Mr. Chairman, has to do, have you ever practiced in rural Alaska?
No, I practiced in Juneau for the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, Juneau's kind of rural, isn't it? Yeah. It doesn't have any roads in or out. I mean, maybe the people don't think that here, but...
Yeah, and we work with women from all over Southeast Alaska. They come here to have their babies.
Are there midwives out in, say, Klawock or Hollis or...
Not that I'm aware of.
Kaufman Cove or someplace like that?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. Anyone else in the audience that would like to testify? At this point, we're going to leave public testimony open. Any closing comments at this point in this hearing? We will leave public testimony open. We're going to put this bill off to the side. We'll pick it up at a further meeting.
Actually, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Is it fair to ask the student who's got 180 births to come on up and kind of give her opinion of what's going on, since we have somebody here that's been down there working where most people play?
Please come forward, state your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Madison Nolan. I was an apprentice in Juneau here for 3 years, and I've actually been licensed since September. So I am a licensed direct entry midwife that works at the Juneau Family Health and Birth Center currently. So,
question, Senator?
Actually, the question that I have is, since you've got 180 births, and I'm assuming that she said assisted, I'm assuming that somebody, you've been the primary provider as well as the one that was there, not just observing. And so, since you have so many births, do you feel like you can be a preceptor? Because the only thing restricting you from being a preceptor right now is a 2-year limit. Isn't that correct?
I do agree that currently the only thing that's restricting me is the 2-year limit.
Mm-hmm.
I think with any profession, you're going to continue to learn and grow as you practice for a longer period of time. And the one thing is, I have attended 180 births since I've started this journey into midwifery, but since I've been licensed, I've actually only attended about 40.
Mm-hmm.
So I currently would not qualify under that, the new tagline of 50 births as well. And I would also say, just for myself and my personal comfort, I would probably want at least a year of licensure under myself before I started to be a preceptor, because I think there's a lot that you can learn during an apprenticeship, and then there's a lot that you need to integrate in that first year. So I think the time component, I agree that it's not as important, but I think for a lot of midwives, it's important to also just be able to learn how to be a midwife practicing on your own.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nolan.
Thank you very much. So with that, we're going to put this bill off to the side.
Chairman, I'd just like to make sure, well, you'd like to hear from the rural hospitals to see if they're affected by this legislation by the next time. And hopefully, if your office or my office can look into that, since I represent 5 rural hospitals that are out there, I want to make sure that they're not negatively affected by it.
I'll take you up on your offer, Senator, and I'm sure that Senator Kelly's office will also be checking on this as well. So we'll look into the rural aspect of this issue. Thank you very much. So with that, we're going to put 156 off to the side. We're going to move on to another bill, SB 190. This is a bill sponsored by Senator Huggins. This is the first hearing on the bill. And we have a CS that's going to be brought before the committee. You ready?
Yep.
Is there a motion to move, or excuse me, is there a motion to adopt the CS?
There is, Mr. Chairman. I move that the committee adopts the CS for Senate Bill 190, version U, as the working document.
And I'll object for the purpose of discussion. Is Mr. Zepp here? Scary, please come forward, state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, my name is Gary Zepp, staff to Senator Huggins. He couldn't be here today, but he sends his regards. If you'd like, I could walk you through the changes in the CS.
Please do.
Okay. Section 1A, page 1, lines 5 through 9. Lines 5 through 7, the verbiage was reworded, and lines 8 and 9 were deleted because this was a duplication that was already contained in AS 0854799C definitions. Section 1B, page 1, lines 10 through 14. Section 1B, page 1, lines 10 through 14, and continuing on page 2, lines 1 through 2. Again, the verbiage was reworded to ensure that the proper unlicensed personnel were delegated certain guide services. And those are the only changes from the CS for Senate Bill 190, version U, as compared to version A.
Okay, and this is a bill that will be heard today and then also put off to the side, so we'll have some time to ask further, deeper questions. And given the number of bills we have today, I just want to make sure that the committee members are aware that we do have several other bills. So I'm going to are there any questions for Mr. Zepp at this point? Okay, I'm going to remove my objection. Is there further objection at this point on the CS? Seeing none, the CS for 190 version U is adopted as a working draft. Any questions, additional questions at this point from members of the committee? Senator Steadman?
Mr. Chairman, it would be nice to have the bill sponsor walk through the bill.
That's okay. I'd be glad to. Thank you again for the record, Gary Zepp, staff to Senator Huggins. The work draft for the committee substitute version U in front of you adds language that authorizes a registered guide outfitter to delegate certain guide duties to unlicensed personnel, such as Section 1A, page 1, lines 5 through 8. This allows the packing of game meat by unlicensed personnel. Section 1B, page 1, lines 9 through 14, and continuing on page 2, lines 1 through 5, it establishes an apprenticeship program structure to prepare unlicensed personnel to be trained for future opportunities as licensed assistant guides and to allow the delegation of certain guide duties to unlicensed personnel as well, as long as the licensed registered guide outfitter or Class A assistant guide is physically present with the unlicensed personnel. And please note that under current statutes, an assistant guide candidate must have at least 60 days of Alaska hunting experience and 30 days must be in a hunting camp being instructed by a licensed guide outfitter. Section 1C, page 2, lines 6 through 9, this is one of the more important parts of this, allows for the unlicensed personnel to be compensated for providing the services previously mentioned. And again, please be aware that current Alaska statutes prohibit unlicensed personnel to be compensated while carrying out these tasks previously mentioned. Section 2A, 9, page 3, line 20, adds conforming language for the new section being added, as previously mentioned, AS 08.54.635. Section 3A, page 4, line 31, and continuing on page 5, lines 1 through 2, this holds the contracting guide outfitter responsible for game or guiding violations, holds the contracting guide outfitter equally responsible for game or guiding violations committed by unlicensed personnel who they employ or hire as an independent contractor. And in closing, Mr. Chairman, committee members, this legislation, again, would allow unlicensed personnel, including local residents, to be hired and compensated for packing meat from the field without having to obtain a license. This bill also creates an apprenticeship structure for unlicensed personnel to receive training and preparation as prospective guides to further advance in the big game guiding industry and meet the qualifications for applying for the assistant guide level in the industry. As you can imagine, it's difficult to find people to work for free. I respectfully ask for your support for Senate Bill 190, and I thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Zeppelin. Before we do that, we're going to probably go beyond three. We'll take a quick break at three, and then we're going to try and continue to a little past three to get through some of the rest of the bills here. But any questions for Mr. Zepp? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at the big game industry, essentially, it's a big business here in the state of Alaska, especially where you have all these international hunters that are coming through for any kind of big game, whether it's bear or muskox or anything like that. Is there anybody opposed to this legislation?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I have not received any letters or any discontent with the proposed legislation.
In particular, have you gotten any reviews or any kind of correspondence with some of the guides that are out there that are going to be that are affected by this, as to whether they're in favor of it or not in favor of it?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, absolutely. I tried to reach out to all the stakeholders I could think of,
sure.
Including the Alaska Wildlife Troopers, mm-hmm. And I believe they're online right now. I also consulted with Sarah Chambers, the Professional Licensing Operations Manager at Commerce. I also consulted with Kelly Vrim, who is the chair of the Big Game Commercial Services Board. Jeff Logan of the Outdoor Alaska Outdoor Council, Eddie Grasser from the Safari Club International, and lastly, John Thor Stacy, the Alaska Professional the Alaska Professional Hunters Association. And so far, I've gotten nothing but support from those folks.
In particular, Kelly Vrim is in favor of it.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions at this point? Seeing none, thank you. We're going to go to invited testimony. Mr. Pitts, are you online? Mr. Pitts, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Could you please state your name for the record, who you may be associated with, and begin your testimony?
Yes, I can. My name is Kevin Pitts. I'm a registered guide and outfitter at 1299, and I'm a member of the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, and just wanted to speak on my own behalf, but I just appreciate you guys letting me testify.
Okay, do you have a I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and you know, being 29 years old, and I'm considered pretty young in the guiding community compared to other outfitters that have been operating, you know, for 20 plus years, and I put my time and effort into obtaining my registered guide outfitter's license, and I now hold the National Park Service guide exclusive concession contract in the Katmai Preserve. So I do plan on using packers in my operation, and I feel that most of the people that come and work, you know, they learn a lot from that packing position, and they need to be compensated for all the hard work that they do. And I ask for your full support and everything for this bill.
Any questions for Mr. Pitts? Seeing none, thank you. Next, we're going to move on to, I hope I pronounced your name correctly, Joe Klusch from King Salmon.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's Joe Klusch. Sounds like a clutch in a car, but it's spelled different. I appreciate the opportunity to testify and thank the committee for scheduling this hearing. Short background, 42 years in rural Alaska, 34 years as a working guide. I started as a packer, and I've got archival history going back to the 1920s from Kodiak in western Alaska. Most of the greatest guides and many of the native guides were packers and became registered and master guides. You have the skills, you have the judgment, you work under supervision. I view this, as I listened in previous testimony and other bills, as a technical correction so that the Department of Law and Public Safety don't have to deal with these discrepancies in statute. We can make it work, and it has been working. I'm not aware of any problems related to packers that except for the statutory problem, and I believe that this legislation as crafted right now will solve our problem. So interest of letting you get on with your business, I'll entertain any questions you want to ask me, but I'm in full support of the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Klusch. Is there any, Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Klusch, thanks for coming online since you're out there where the rubber hits the road and dealing with clients as well as packing the game out, which is required by state law. My question has to do with the wildlife troopers, the game wardens out there in particular. Have you run into trouble with where there has been a violation and been cited for somebody, either some overly aggressive game warden?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Olson, not that I'm aware of. this just came to light, I guess, about a year ago, and the issue was to how to address it and correct the statutes so that this activity, this level of service within the profession could continue. It's essential economically. It takes manpower to move an entire moose, or this is hard work, and packers are part of the deal. I was one to begin with, and I've got the ailing knees to prove it. But that being said, no, I am not aware at all of any citations and the troopers can clarify this. So I'm not aware of any.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Klutch. Any other questions from the senators for Mr. Klutch? Seeing none, thank you. Hey, Kelly Verm, are you online?
Yes, this is Kelly Verm. I'm the current chairman of the Big Game Commercial Services Board, and I've been operating as a guide or an assistant guide for 41 years, since 1973. I've wanted to be a guide since I was in elementary school, and the first guide that I was aware of was Marlon Grasser, who was Eddie Grasser's father. Packers have had a history in the guiding business as far back, well, since statehood, and as Mr. Klutch said, even beyond. This was an accepted in practice, and we assumed that it was legal, and to our surprise, about a year ago, we discovered that technically, according to the statute, this issue wasn't addressed, and it appears to be at face value illegal. This legislation will legitimize what's been a long established practice in this business, in this industry rather. And in 1989 and 1990, the Alaska Senate instituted a task force on guide and guiding, and it defined who was transporters, who was guides, and describe the privileges according to each one of those. This was chaired by Senator Fahrenkamp, and she was assisted by Senators Fakes and Pierce. The task force addressed this issue. They discussed it and decided that these entry-level guys and or the laborers that just wanted a pack of moose didn't rise to the level of licensure. Unfortunately, this wasn't clarified. In 08, 54, 790, and in the definition section. And 0854 790 is a direct descendant of this task force on guides and guiding that was back in the 1989 and 90. So this is a technical correction, and there's no objection to it that I'm aware of. And I have one insertion we'd like to make. Page 2, line 1, the word assistant guide needs to be inserted into that sentence to allow that person to supervise a trainee. Right now we have registered guide outfitter or a Class A, and we need to add assistant guide to that line. And I would appreciate your support, and I'll entertain any questions.
Any questions for Kelly? I've got one, Kelly. Do you still have Rudy?
Yes, I do. Rudy's doing good.
Okay, thank you. Going on next to Fairbanks, Joe Want, are you online?
Hello?
Joe, can you state your name for the record and begin your testimony?
Yes, my name is Joe Want, W-A-N-T. I'm testifying for myself, and I'm in Fairbanks. I certainly don't disagree with the general concept of what they're trying to accomplish here, because I think it's they're right. The problem is that right, if the wording in B is not changed, you're going to open a giant Pandora's box in that a guide, depending on how they define present, and you have to keep in mind, I believe, that right now, the way the regulations are set up, we can have somebody guiding the sheep, goats, brown bear, or whatever, and have never seen the animals before. In addition to that, I think it needs to be kept in mind that the Big Game Commercial Services Board last December passed a regulation which was just signed by the Lieutenant Governor that will essentially allow a supervising guide to be supervising a hunt that's 300-400 miles away because of the way that's worded in for continuous or adjacent game management units. My main concern with this is the situation where the Commercial Services Board defines a distance of, say, 100 yards. You now have a packer. You can take that packer and designate him all these authorities or privileges or whatever you want to call them that are normally assigned to a guy. Put that packer in 7,500 yards away. Leave him there and then move 50. And then that packer, who knows who has no experience, is in a position of making decisions regarding the killing. That section would, I don't believe that there's any reason that the
killing, tracking, or pursuing or attempting to kill the game should be included in that. There's no question that the Packers should be using a spotting scope and doing those types of things, but not directly involved in the kill. The next thing, and I've spoken to several individuals, I think Mr. Zepp was one of them, about I believe it's important that the guy always be in between the decision-making process between the Packer and the client. How that's going to be accomplished, I don't know. By that, I mean that if the Packer is going to have input on how the animal is killed, then that needs to go through the guide. It should not be directly from the Packers. Because we're creating, we already have a giant loophole where the Class A assistant guide or assistant guide or Class A assistant guide may have never seen the animal or the guide. We're just adding another class of people, potentially, that are conducting these hunts or participating in the hunt that shouldn't be. And again, I'm in full support of what's trying to be accomplished here, but I have real concerns about the latitude that they're giving the guy for assigning for delegating this quote-unquote authority this morning.
Thank you, Joe. Any questions for Mr. Watt? Seeing none, thank you. At this point, again, we're going to leave public testimony open. We're going to put the bill off to the side. Are there any closing questions or comments from members of the committee? With that, we'll pick this bill up at a later date. We're now going to move on to SB 140, ADA, Arctic Development Authority.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, before we get going on too long, I give you an extra 5 or 10 minutes, but that's about it. So I don't know what you want to do with your schedule, but I don't see any way unless we're going to sit here for a few more hours, we're going to get through this list.
Well, let's work on 140 here, and then we'll call it at 3 o'clock. We'll take a break, and we'll see how far we get through this. So SB 140, Senator McGuire, this is the second hearing on the bill, and there's a CS to bring before the committee. Is there a motion to move to adopt the CS?
There is, Mr. Chairman. I move that the committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 140, version R, as the working document.
I'll object for the purposes of discussion. So in front of us, we have Jesse Logan and Senator McGuire. Please introduce yourself for the record, and we'll begin our testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm going to go ahead just in the interest of time. We all know what the bill's about, and I'm just going to have my staff, Jesse Logan, walk through the changes that are in the committee substitute in front of you.
Please.
For the record, Jesse Logan, staff of Senator McGuire. There was a few changes made to this bill in the CS version you have before you. The Section 1, I believe you all have an explanation of changes as well in front of you. This establishes a mechanism for ADA to create a dividend program for returns net income on this fund to return to the general funds in the same way that the revolving loan fund and the SETS fund do. This basically allows us to invest in ourselves and make money. But that's not the goal. Section 2 and Section 3 are definitional sections of net income and unrestricted net income. Sections 4 through 9, there were no changes. In Section 10, we inserted a majority vote of the members to allow for funds or assets transferred between funds. And we did this to create a little bit of oversight. It allows ADA to transfer funds between the funds that it controls, but only by an action of the board. The members of ADA are effectively their board of directors. We also removed on page 7, line 11, the word application. It reduces an encumbrance of an application being filled out, but the due diligence on the application of the project remain unchanged within ADA. And in section 11, we changed line 8, page 8, line 1 through 6, a new definition of Arctic infrastructure development was established. Section 19, Arctic infrastructure development means the construction or improvement or rehabilitation or expansion of a facility. We removed road, port, energy project, hangar, etc., so as to not pigeonhole future development for ideas that we had not come up with yet. We also included Section 19A, any facility essentially in the Arctic to aid in development or meet emergency response needs. And then B, anywhere else in the state if the construction improvement or rehabilitation or expansion supports further development of the facility in the Arctic. This allows this fund to be eligible to be used for areas outside of the geographical definition of the Arctic to use this fund to support development within the Arctic. For example, if a large port was being built up north in the Bering Sea, we would need places to house and support that effort. That is the extent of the changes.
Thank you. I'll remove my objection and ask for further objection. Seeing none, the CS for 190 version U is adopted as a working draft. Questions for members of the committee?
See, we're dealing with backslash R, aren't we? Not dealing.
Yeah. Brief at ease. Back online. Let me correct, self-correct. I remove my objection and I ask for further, objection. Seeing none, the CS for 190 version R is adopted as working draft. With that, do we have questions for members of the committee?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
I want to thank Bill's sponsor for sponsoring this bill. It's something that's going to certainly affect my area of the, since I represent the North Slope as well as the Northwest Arctic area. So I thank the sponsor for putting this forward.
Thank you. Okay.
So with your encouragement, I'd like to move it out today.
Are there any amendments?
I have comments on the original bill before I...
Senator Machicki.
Or a question, actually, for the sponsor, and I very much like the bill as well. I appreciate you bringing it forward. I do have a question, though, and we've talked a little bit with your staff, but want to get perhaps Ada's take on this, and that is in section... Page 7, line 15, section 44, 88, 840, limitations on financing. Mm-hmm. I just find it interesting that they can make a loan for more than one-third of the capital cost of an Arctic infrastructure project or a loan guarantee if the amount of the guarantee exceeds $20 million. Is ADA not in for... Essentially, although it's a guarantee, you're not providing the actual capital. It really does. It locks ADA in to a larger amount. Is that correct? Can you?
So my understanding, and ADA's online, so I think it would be great to get their testimony, is that we divided these two out, working with your office, Senator Machicki, so that it would be or. So either it's a loan for more than one-third of the capital costs, or it's a loan guarantee, so that we separated out the two. But I would like to have ADA respond, if they could, online to what they feel. They're not online.
I don't believe ADA is online. ADA, are you online? They're not online.
Through the chair, Senator, if I may.
Absolutely. Well, I'm not the chair.
This
Mark Davis, did you hear me?
Excuse me. Apparently, Ada is online. Mr. Davis, can you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Mark Davis, Deputy Director of ADA.
Senator Machicki, do you want to ask the question to Mr. Davis?
Yeah, actually, what I wanted to do is essentially get out on the table Section 44 on limitations on financing. If you can cover number one and two for us, I think it's important to get described for the public.
Certainly, Senator, through the chair, Mr. Davis, for the record. The limitations are designed so that ADA is essentially always working with the private sector on these types of financing. We've agreed to these types of limitations in the CESS fund, which is also previously sponsored by Senator McGuire and Representative Pruitt. There is a bill to amend that slightly, but there are still limitations, and we agree with those. The idea of a loan at one-third is that we really would prefer to use private sector lending if possible. And ADA's main program on that is this loan participation, which works with commercial banks. On the loan guarantee, the idea is not to exceed a certain amount so that our bonding capability remains intact. Yeah,
Senator Chicken.
Okay, so just to read it, authority may not use the Arctic Infrastructure Development Fund for a loan more than one-third of the capital cost of an Arctic infrastructure development or a loan guarantee if the amount of the guarantee exceeds $20 million. So a loan guarantee cap is $20 million.
Right, and yeah, that's right. And the other thing I should add is, of course, that both of those limitations can be waived by the legislature, and they, in fact, were waived last session in SB 23 with support of the Interior Energy Project. But we feel that if we're really going to take on a very large project like that, it's appropriate for ADA to come back to the legislature.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Davis. Briefly, we're going to work on this bill for a few more minutes here. The bills, unfortunately, SB 99 and SB 193, we're going to have to wait till the next committee hearing. Is there a are there any amendments?
Yes, I have an amendment, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment R2.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Senator Machicchetti, would you like to speak to the amendment?
I would. Members, I assume, have a copy of the amendment. Essentially, what it does is it allows, I'll read it. Notwithstanding A of the section, the authority may not provide financing or loans or bond guarantees in an amount less than $7 million for the purchase or repair of a fishing vessel used in a federally managed fishery, the purchase of quota shares of individual fishing quota used in a federally managed fishery in the Arctic, or the construction, improvement, rehabilitation, or expansion of a plant, facility, or equipment used in support of a state-managed fishery in the Arctic.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members of the committee regarding the amendment? Senator Olson.
The sponsor of the bill in favor of the amendment.
I am, through the chair, Senator Olson. Thank you for the question, and I do support the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Steadman.
Mr. Chairman, if we can just get a brief explanation of I don't have a problem with the amendment, but just for those watching at home, why the amendment put forward and the purpose of it, other than a direct statutory read.
Senator Machicchi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Essentially, what this amendment allows is the support of Arctic infrastructure and Arctic-related projects for ports that are not necessarily in the Arctic. So if the necessary skills or materials or technical ability is not available in a port in the Arctic, until that expertise is developed, we can help support that in subarctic ports. So there may be one in southeast, maybe one in Seward area or Homer or one of the other port areas.
Any additional questions of Senator Machicchi on the amendment?
The maker of the amendment, I guess, what does it do to the fiscal note, if anything?
Well, it has no effect on the fiscal note. It's the same, essentially, what it does. And if you see the amount, may not provide financing or loans or bond guarantees in an amount less than $7 million, because there are other programs that meet that $7 million limit. This is over and above that. So I haven't seen, let's look at the fiscal note, because there shouldn't be a change. Okay, this does not add fund balance. It adds the ability to provide a fund for what ADA already has in stock, if you will.
And ADA is in favor of it?
Mr. Davis, you still online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Now, can you comment on the amendment that was put forward by Senator Machicchi? Is ADA in favor of that amendment?
Generally, ADA is in favor of the amendment. We only have one comment, which is in line 8. We would suggest striking state managed so that what we're being authorized to do here is to support both federal and state managed fisheries.
Okay, any additional questions? Or Senator Steadman?
I'd like some further comment on that, if it's acceptable to the amendment sponsor, that we make that slight change in the amendment or not.
I think the goal here was to support both state and federally managed fisheries in the Arctic, and I think removing state managed probably has no impact. Yeah. I think it allows both. I'll read it slowly while we're chatting here, but give me just one moment. If you
take a brief ease. in session. Senator Matucci?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have no no problem with removing the words state managed in line 8 from the amendment.
Senator Stedman?
Sounds fine. I mean, so we've got an amendment to the amendment.
So we need to move.
So that's for objection.
Excuse me?
That's for objection to the amendment.
Is there object for the purpose of discussion to the amendment of the amendment? Let's do a brief at ease. Back in session. Senator Matucci.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to, if the chairman will allow, I'd like to withdraw motion moving amendment R2.
Without objection. Motion's been withdrawn.
And I'd like to make a motion to move amendment R2 as amended.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
And just on the record, we have the discussion of removing the word state managed. So I move the amendment as I previously read with the word state managed removed from the original amendment.
Are there any questions from the members? I'll remove my objection. We have some folks to testify if we have questions. Are there any questions for members of the board? We have a series of folks that could be here to, or could be answering questions if we have it. That's Hugh Short, CEO, with said Point Capital is available to answer questions. Larry Cotter is available with CEO for Lucian Pribilof Island Community Development Association. Ron Long, City of Seward, and Myron Nanning, President of Association of Village Council Presidents. Members of the committee, do you have questions for these folks? If so, we'll bring them forward.
You want a motion to move the bill?
Seeing none, I'm going to remove my objection, and just going to open this to public testimony. Is there anyone in the public that wishes to testify on this issue? Anyone online? Ron Long. Mr. Long, can you quickly identify yourself for the record and give your testimony, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Long, representing the City of Seward. And I know you've been at it a long time, so I'll be brief. We are in support of for the committee substitute 140 draft version R2 as amended for the same logic as represented by the sponsor and the sponsor of the amendment, and consistent with our previous testimony in the original bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Long? Seeing none, is anyone additional folks online to testify? Seeing that, we'll close public testimony. Any questions for members of the committee?
Pass it out.
what is the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move CS 140 version R as amended out of committee with individual recommendations attached to physical note.
Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, the bill moves out of committee, and we're going to take a brief at ease. At this point, we're going to adjourn the meeting, and we'll be back at the next our next committee meeting, and we'll be hearing the bills we did not get to today, and that would be SB 99 and SB 193. We're adjourned.